You're listening to a special podcast version of I'm Ready for My Close-Up, which is designed to complement the current broadcast version on Resonance FM, which is about the London Film Festival all this week. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode I'm talking to Robert Ryder, the cinema programmer at the Barbican, about their season of silent horror movies, which continues tonight, the 30th of October, at 10:45 p.m., with a screening of The Man Who Laughs, with a live accompaniment by DJ Nacho Martin. Also, we're talking about their season of New York Met operas projected in the cinema, which includes John Adams's Dr. Atomic, and Berlioz's The Damnation of Faust, directed by Robert Lepage. I'm talking to Robert Ryder, the head of the Barbican Cinema Department. I actually interviewed you a year ago about some of the things that were screening, so it's nice to catch up a year on, because as ever, the film programme at the Barbican continues to be very varied and showing things from all over the world in different sort of decades from the last 100 years. I mean, recently you had an anime season looking at the work of Tezuka, and that ranged from a Kimishi Bai exhibition, which is almost the prehistory of cinema, to his most recent work. So presumably showing like the width and breadth of cinema history is something that's fairly important to you.
Yes, very much so. We're in a very fortunate position here at the Barbican, and indeed fortunate, I would say privileged position, in that although we don't have huge budgets, we're one of a few cinemas which is actually able to bring materials, to bring prints from across the world for particular seasons. We can't do it all the time, but we can on occasions. So the Tezuka season and all his work had hardly ever been seen here in the UK. Mm-hmm. Over the years, we were the first cinema, and I'm particularly proud of the fact that we were the first cinema in the UK to screen a complete retrospective of the work of Miyazaki. Mm-hmm. And the whole Studio Ghibli output or work that he had done there at his studios. So this carried on very much in that animation vein. Yes, and as I said, we're in the fortunate position of being able to present these seasons from various parts of the world, and it is very much part of our commitment as a cinema within an art centre present work, to present films and seasons that reflect and complement other things which are happening here at the Barbican Centre.
And presumably the more of these seasons that you do, the easier it becomes to liaise with film archives in different countries all over the world, because presumably you had to deal with various people in Japan for the Tezuka season and for your upcoming silence, perhaps, the Murnau Foundation and so on.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. And so you're always building up your contacts. I mean, you do reach a point where you are, although many of the people I've never met face to face, but have had been working with over quite a few years now. So you do feel as if you've got a relationship, and that does make things easier when from time to time you're trying to get a print of a film from a country that you haven't had any dealings with in the past, then it can be just more complicated. But obviously with the internet now and the way that you can just find, I mean, a few years ago it would be so difficult. You'd have to go via the British Film Institute information department, and they may or may not have contact details. But now life is certainly easier trying to make those contacts. Mm.
And in terms of actually showing the films, presumably you have a variety of different types of equipment, whether it's 35mm, 16mm, or even HD these days.
Yes, again, in the past, when the only materials that could be shown to the public were 35mm or occasionally 16mm, it was difficult, and there were times, and it's happened to all cinemas and cinema techs around the world, where the print didn't turn up, and so you sometimes might have 300 people in a screening. I mean, fortunately this didn't happen very often, but it has happened, and suddenly you've got to announce that the film has not arrived. It's stuck in customs at Heathrow or something like that. But now, because of all the digital revolution, we are in a position sometimes whereby, or we could be in a position, I don't think this has ever happened, but a film may be stuck in customs, as I said, metaphorically speaking. We might well have a DVD And rather than disappoint those people and not show the film at all, we can project the DVD through our digital projectors, which are 2K machines that we were awarded by the UK Film Council. And the image is, it's not as good as 35mm film, but the DVD projected is passable. So at least you don't send that audience home empty-handed without. So on a logistical level, on a practical level, life has got easier, yes.
Well, presumably, if it's a film that's hardly ever projected or even shown on TV in this country, you know, the audience would be happy to see it in whatever format it's available. Because I noticed with your Tezuka season that in the listings on your website, some of the films didn't have accompanying pictures, presumably because no one had ever actually taken a still from that film, or if they had, it had long been lost.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right, yeah. Another example, was recently we held the Bicycle Film Festival, which has been going for quite a few years in Montreal, New York. It's been in Europe, and it's been to London before, and we were really pleased to be able to host it this year. And nearly all the material, all the films which were showed, were actually projected from DV Cam. Now, this was and the Bicycle Film Festival chooses to show from that format, which is not really a professional format at all, but it was amazing, the quality of the films through our digital projectors. Lots of the screenings were sold out, and no one at any point said, you know, wasn't impressed by the quality of these films. So it's to have the flexibility that comes from having all these different formats and being able to show them through digital high definition projectors does mean that the audience is getting a much better experience, and you don't have to disappoint people in the way that it did from time to time happen in the past.
The scheduling of certain films is kind of dictated by when a print becomes available, because you showed Diabolique last month, which I think had been previously shown at the NFT a month earlier in their superhero season, and then was shown again at the Sci-Fi Film Festival later last month, although I think actually they showed a version that had been recorded off TV.
I'm not sure what materials we had for that. I kind of can't remember, but it was sold out, and it was a great season. It was a great evening. Yeah.
I mean, with something like that, it's almost like you're tapping into the zeitgeist, the fact that all of a sudden films that presumably were popular, you know, at their time seem to sort of slip out of cultural memory and then become rediscovered. Because that was attached to, I think it was a talk by an Italian music expert.
Yes, it was, yeah. No, we are constantly looking for interesting work. A lot of the time we're approached by programmers and curators saying, I've prepared this talk which goes with a certain film, would you be interested? We don't automatically say yes, but we if it fits within the general kind of overview of what we're trying to achieve here at the Barbican, then we generally have a very open-minded approach. This is particularly or it becomes very much the case with our silent film with live music series. Excuse me, because there are a lot of musicians now who've become interested in silent film, and on a fairly regular basis, we have emails and phone calls from musicians saying, I've composed a new score for such and such a film. Would you be interested in taking it at the Barbican? We've built up our silent film program with live music over probably the last 5 or 6 years now. We had been showing silent films in the past, but over the last 5 or 6 years we've really tried to develop that series, and have done so very successfully. And in fact, I think I may have mentioned before, we tried to establish a home for silent film in London. And yesterday we started a series called Shadows and Monsters, silent film and the horror genre, and we showed The Hands of Orlac, directed by Robert Wiener in 1924. It was sold out and accompanied by John Sweeney. And this again raises quite an interesting issue, because this film, there is no print of it, no 35mm print with English intertitles.
Okay.
So again, we had to be adaptable and think, how can we get around this problem? There are various ways you can do it. You can project subtitles on the screen, mm. and that's one way of doing it. But then you still have to hire in equipment in order to do that. But we had all the intertitles translated into English, mm. and then after that, we hired a voice artist to read the titles in English as the German intertitles came up. And John Sweeney, our musician, just went slightly softer in mm. his playing at that time. It worked marvelously, yes. It was a great success.
Well, I was going to say, because also I think that happened at some of your Tezuka screenings, that Jonathan Clements did the translation of the subtitles.
Yes, yeah. No, it's a good way forward. Mm. You know, ideally the best way would be to rent the equipment in order to project the subtitles, but mm. when that's not feasible, sometimes it's just sheer cost of doing that on a regular basis. We have done it from time to time. And also, there's a time issue, because all those subtitles have got to be keyed in to mm. a computer, and if they don't already exist in English, then the time factor comes into it as well.
Although performing a sort of a spoken soundtrack rather than a musical one to a silent movie is perhaps bringing it closer to some of the original performances of these silent movies, 80 or 90 years ago. Because I remember last year I was talking to Matthew Sweet, who did the documentary Silent Britain, and he was saying that was actually quite a common practice in sort of Edwardian times, particularly with experimental movies from Germany, that they would almost have a narrator on the stage explaining it for audiences who might be unfamiliar with the style or the context of the film.
Yes, yeah. It's interesting you say that. I'm not sure to the extent to which the extent of what it happened in the UK mm. And in the rest of Europe, but certainly in Japan there was a major. It was part of the silent film, or it wasn't called silent film. It was a part of the mm. film experience, that there would be a narrator who would actually tell the story, and the narrator in themselves was actually part of the show. Mm. It was central. It was a key part, and some of them became big stars simply because they could tell the stories they could act out the stories with so much theatrical colour.
Which kind of links it to the Kimishibai performance that you had here.
Yes, very much so. Which again, for any of your listeners who don't know, this is a form of storytelling with visual images that tell the story with the verbal storytelling at the same time. It was a precursor to cinema, but because it had a visual element, you can see it as very much as part of that same tradition.
Well, I mean, I think this is something that very much interests Matthew about silent film, is that it has this performative nature, that it's open to new interpretation by the way that you add new musical scores, the way you might have a translation of the intertitles, that it becomes almost theatrical, you know, not to use theatre in the American sense of the word, where they call all cinemas theatres, but to actually have an interactive sort of nature to it, where every performance of a silent movie is different, and therefore it becomes more like theatre than cinema.
Yes, very much so, because, as we all know, all of us who've done various media studies and film studies courses, this whole notion of cinema being, after Walter Benjamin, a form of mechanical reproduction, then suddenly any live element disappears from traditional cinema, or cinema as it has been since the talkies, since 1929. There's never the possibility that anything might go wrong in the way in theatre or music or any of the performing arts. There's a sense of excitement. There's a thrill because it is a live event, and once you introduce live music or indeed voice or other forms of performance with the film, it as you said sort of brings it more to a theatrical experience.
Do you think that's why there's suddenly become a new audience for silent cinema, because it actually is quite a different experience to going to a regular talkie film?
I hope so, and I think that could be the case. Certainly audiences are building for silent film. And I would like to think that it's not simply people just coming as a one-off, that it's not just simply people saying, I've never seen a silent film with live music, I'll give it a bash. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but I do hope that what we are doing is bringing people back and building that audience for silent film as a genre in its own right. And, when I look at the audiences that are attending the Barbican, I do see the same faces coming back again and again. And I sense that there's a growing number of people who are interested in silent film per se.
I mean, because although art house cinemas in general seem to be diminishing in number, which is a great shame, there isn't an equivalent flourishing of silent movies and world cinema on TV. If anything, with the proliferation of digital channels, we seem to be getting less alternative programming, which is bizarre. And so I was wondering, if places like the Barbican, by being the only venue you can show these films, actually encourages new audiences. Because when I was young, I remember they did show things like Laurel and Hardy and Buster Keaton and full-length silent movies on Channel 4, but they don't even seem to anymore.
Yes. There was a whole series as well called Thames Silence, which Thames TV put money in for Carl Davis to write scores for a group of, I think, maybe six or maybe more films. It was a major silent film project on television. Mm. Again, when you're watching a silent film with music on television, then it's a pre-recorded act, so that the very thrill of being involved in a live performance doesn't come across. But by no means would I still advocate and relish greater silent film on television. I suppose it goes in phases, it goes in ebbs and flows, it becomes fashionable for a while amongst television programmers and then goes out of fashion. Maybe the sheer costs involved in because most of those Thames Silence were with symphony orchestras, so the costs of producing those TV shows would have been extensive. With the silent films here that we have at the Barbican, we have a variety of musical accompaniments. We've had a chamber orchestra on the cinema stage at one point, and sometimes we'll be just working, I say just, not in a negative sense, but we'll be working with one pianist who will provide an improvised accompaniment. Sometimes we'll have a jazz band or a string quartet, so we're very open to new musical accompaniments. Again, the absolutely central thing for us is that the music works sympathetically with the film, and that we don't have bands here who see the performance as a music gig with the film in the background. It's got to be a musical accompaniment that respects the film as it was originally made. And that's our main priority. That's our key criteria for all musicians.
Well, like you say, the musical accompaniment you've got for these silent movies runs the full gamut, from orchestra to experimental electronic music to piano accompaniment. When it comes to choosing these soundtracks, then, is it a mixture of people approaching you with, I've got an idea for a score with a silent film, or you thinking that I'd like to curate this year's silence to be around horror, and then maybe thinking of the variety of musical accompaniment you might have?
Yeah. Sometimes it goes either way. Sometimes a musician will suggest something that they've written a score for, and then we will think, right, let's use that as a starting point. In fact, this very series, Shadows and Monsters, Horror in Silent Film, came from that. John Sweeney, who launched the Strand yesterday, the pianist, about a year ago said to me that he had played The Hands of Orlac and would we be interested in doing it sometime. And it was from his suggestion, I'd always put it on my agenda for some future date, that I hadn't seen it. I'd seen a remake of it with Peter Lorre made in Hollywood called Mad Love, which sort of follows the same story. And so I was very keen to present the original film. So then we decided, having had done a series on German Expressionism some years ago, we then decided to put together this little horror in silent film series. So sometimes it comes from the musicians. Sometimes it will come from the films. You know, there'll be a group of films that we haven't shown. And another point I will make is that you do reach a point with silent film that you just want to explore new areas. Films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Metropolis, Nosferatu, they get shown so frequently. Well, actually, I can't say frequently because that's actually not the case. But in terms of silent cinema, they come up on a more regular basis. So we are, having shown those, and we will show them again, but having shown those, we're now looking to give our audiences a chance to see some of the more obscure work and films that they might not previously have seen.
And presumably, if you choose slightly more obscure titles, if you were to then find a musical accompaniment that is perhaps a bit hipper, for want of a better word, that might then bring in a different audience. I mean, for example, The Man Who Laughs is being accompanied by DJ Nacho Martin, yes. And De Gollum is with Reflector, both, yes, of which, yes, obviously are fairly experimental, you know, yes, scores. Yes. I mean, yes. How did those two collaborations come about?
Nacho Martin is a DJ. He's based in Hackney. He plays in clubs, and he's also produced scores using his turntables for several silent films, and he's been here a couple of times before, okay, as well. His music, just to reassure people who might think that they're getting his club set with drum and bass or garage music, or I'm not sure. I haven't heard Nacho Martin in the club, so I'm not sure what he's where he leans. But he really respects the films, and he plays a totally sympathetic mix of sounds to accompany the work. So I'm really, really looking forward to see what he comes up with for The Man Who Laughs. Generally, I will say, we do try to hear the soundtracks first. It's not always possible, but we will go and see the musicians perform at another venue and just see how they work with the film. With Der Golem, we have Jan Kopinski, who's based in Nottingham. He has worked again with silent film over quite a few years. His work is fairly experimental, but he has flutes, he has keyboards, he has percussion, and again produces a sound that really works with the film that he's playing to.
Well, and also The Man Who Laughs seems a particularly apt choice this year, because it's the sort of first filmic example of the character that would influence the Joker, who is obviously flavour of the month with,
yes,
The Dark Knight coming,
yes,
out.
Yes, no, it's really interesting. I wondered, for your listeners who don't know, this is the story of a man who's been inflicted with this permanent grin on his face, and I just wondered whether the Joker character had actually come from that at some earlier era.
I suspect so.
Yeah.
At the other end of the scale, the other combination of music and projection that you've got this autumn is broadcasts of Metropolitan Opera productions. Presumably that's in order to make opera more accessible to wider audiences at a much cheaper price than going to, you know, the Royal Opera House or wherever.
Well, it's that and more, because the series that we are transmitting and showing live actually come from the Metropolitan Opera House in New York. So, you know, it's a fantastic opportunity to be able to see, without traveling across the Atlantic, to get the atmosphere and experience the power and grandeur of being at the opera, sitting comfortably in our Cinema One. There's a number of cinemas around the country, around the UK, who are presenting these live operas. They've been exceptionally successful. Nearly everyone has sold out, and we're really pleased to be presenting them here at the Barbican. It makes sense for us to be presenting them, because obviously we've got the concert hall here. We've got a huge number of proportion of our audience that comes to the Barbican comes for the music. So there's an immediate crossover and interest from our audiences.
because although opera has been broadcast on TV in the past, obviously the size of the screen at home and, you know, the quality of the speakers that you like to have won't be the same as in a proper cinema auditorium. So while this is a different experience to going to see the opera performed, at least it has this sort of grandeur to it, like you said, but at the same time has a cinematic quality, because the people filming the performance will then choose to do long shots, to do certain cuts, to do certain zoom-ins of performances. Yeah. I mean, that sort of, I don't know, intersection between cinema and live performance, do you see that as something that's going to sort of actually continue to flourish, or it's just maybe this sort of niche interest that complements opera but will never sort of fully replace it?
Well, I mean, going back to what we were saying before, it seems to me that you know, if our audience here had the chance to be actually sitting in the Opera House in New York, for myself, I'd rather be doing that. I'd rather be experiencing the live performance. I don't think this mixture between the cinematic spectacle and opera as a spectacle, as a live experience, is necessarily going to replace opera on the stage. But obviously, it's a fantastic opportunity to have a taste, and more than a taste, you know, to experience it in a very vivid way without actually making the journey over there. And you can't do that week by week. We're showing the operas, the whole series, I think there are 10 in the series that go right through to 09. What is interesting, you raise an interesting point about the fact that the Met has a production team working there in New York, and they do produce it's a production. It comes over as a big screen experience, which has been produced. And what I think is of interest is that there could be some audiences who would rather the camera were just simply placed in front of the proscenium and were just given the experience that you would probably get if you were sitting in a particular seat in the stalls. We haven't had any complaints at all, so you know, I'm assuming that the audience are very happy with the production they get. It does mean that you get close-ups of the singers' faces, then it will pull back and you'll have a long shot. So you do get something of the variation that you get when you're watching a production of an opera on television. But as you said, you're watching it on a huge screen in the cinema, so it's very much an added experience.
I mean, if you are going to watch it in the cinema, they might as well start using more of the tools of cinema, like, you know, close-ups and cutting, because otherwise, in a way, it's diminishing the experience, because you've got the opportunity to add an extra level of interaction through the camera work and the editing. It would seem a shame not to do that when projecting it.
Yes, I just wonder whether there, these are just my own thoughts, whether some of the opera purists would prefer not to have the gadgets and the gimmickry. And actually, I'm debasing it now because it's not as rampant as that. But you know, some of the editing techniques and various things that you could do if you really wanted to change, you know, your experience of the visual presentation.
I mean, I've not watched any opera on DVD or Blu-ray, but that's the kind of technology actually which would give audiences the chance to experience the camera angle they wanted, where you could have a variety of different cameras on the DVD and actually just choose to have the long shot throughout, or let the director choose the close-ups for you.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you can watch some football games and you can watch the goal being scored from a multitude of angles. So, yes, it does mean that, I suppose, if you're watching it on television, not in a social environment of a cinema where there's got to be one angle that's going to keep the whole audience contented, but certainly if you're watching it on television, if you've got that opportunity, that might be that could well be an additional choice that audiences would be pleased with.
And do you know if any other opera houses around the world have shown any interest in doing this as well? Because if it continues to prove popular, you might then be able to see operas that were only performed in Japan or France or wherever without being having to leave the Barbican or the NFT.
Yes, yeah. Well, the Royal Opera in Covent Garden has started to do it, and I think E&O have done a couple as well. We decided not to take up those transmissions. For no other reason than the fact that we are simply in London. And so maybe if we were in Manchester or Liverpool or outside of London, we might well have done it. But the fact that we are so close to the Opera House, it just felt that the audiences might well decide to go there rather than here. And also, we'd already signed up and were committed to the Met Opera for this current season. So we will decide next year.
And also, some of the collaborators in the operas that you're broadcasting are people who have done works live here anyway in the past, so it sort of complements your previous programming.
Yes. Well, our next opera is John Adams' Dr. Atomic. And yes, in fact, John Adams has been here. He's performed here in the Barbican Hall. We showed a film of his opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, here and presented the premiere here. Some time ago. So yes, it's good to make those connections with artists with whom we have already worked.
And I've seen films here by Robert Lepage as well.
Yes. Again, that's very much part of what the Barbican artistically is about, trying to make those links between the different art forms. So Robert Lepage was performing in the Barbican Theatre. He's obviously directed a number of films in Canada. So we presented a season of his films, and for one of them he came and did a Q&A as part of our Screen Talk series. And it makes for a very positive relationship.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
For more info about Barbican screenings, please visit www.barbican.org.uk. And to hear my previous interview with Robert Ryder, as well as a variety of other shows about silent movies, please visit my blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.